Okay, I'm Ralph White, and I am an alcoholic. And we are coming now to an end. Haven't had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I noticed we had a lot of people who were fairly new. Even though I know in this group, that doesn't mean a lot. Probably most people are kind of familiar with what it is we do. But that 12th step, I know everybody knows the story about the, most people in here know our history, right? Some people are not, who doesn't? Okay, in December of 1934, there was a New York stockbroker, Bill Wilson. He's our founder. And he found himself in the same hospital that he had been in three times previously during that year of 1934. And he was a hopeless drunk. I like to read his story because Bill Wilson drank like me. He drank like I smoked and drank. Cold dude. And when he went in the hospital in December of 1934, the doctor who had seen him previously each time he went in told his wife, get a black dress. Dude is probably not coming up out of here this time and it does not look good. If he comes up out of here, he's gonna probably need 24/7 treatment and he may have a wet brain. Bad news. Bill Wilson said he almost welcomed that idea. He knew he was on his last legs, hopeless. Charlie talked a minute ago about the hopelessness of the first step. Dude was tore up. And something happened to him that December in 1934. And what happened to him was so remarkable, it scared him, the event itself. He was in the hospital room. He had what he later described as a white light experience. And that he described it as a wind blowing through the room with the windows closed, white light filling the room. Described it various ways at different times. At any rate, it scared him. And I'm glad that it happened to Bill Wilson and it didn't happen to me. Because if something like that had happened to me, I'd have thought it was one of those PCP flashbacks and we wouldn't have no Alcoholics Anonymous. But it happened to the right man at the right time in the right hospital with the right doctor. And it scared him, this experience. So he called the doctor and he recounted his experience to the doctor. Check this out. The doctor, from the outside looking in, doctor wasn't in the room when it happened. Doctor has seen this dude's act before. You know how we go up in treatment and people get used to seeing us and we full of drag and we full of manipulation and we full of, so why would I believe anything Ralph is saying? Yeah, you losing your mind. But the doctor, from the outside looking in, when Bill recounted his story, there was something that was going on in that interaction. And the doctor told him, dude, I don't know what happened to you, but you would look good holding on to it. And Bill Wilson left Towns Hospital that December in 1934, and he set about looking for people like me and you. And in 6 months period of time, nobody had got sober. I've heard it estimated upwards of 96. Ernie Kurt says between 40 and 60 drunks Bill Wilson called on in that period of time. Talking to him, preaching to him. You need to have this experience. He's because he don't know no different. Right? He doesn't have a basis for, Charlie keeps saying basis, he has no basis of comparison for what had happened to him. So he's telling all these guys, you need this to happen. Nobody's staying sober, right? And in that 6 months period, some of his boys he used to do some business with said, we got a business opportunity. We'd like you to represent our interests out of town. And if this business goes off well, you'll be set. And Bill Wilson needed to be set. Him and his wife had been to I don't know how many different places they had lived in that last couple of years. They were in bad shape financially. And if this business had gone through, it would have meant a lot of money for him and a position. But he traveled to Akron, Ohio, and his business did not come off too well. Business was a failure. He went out on a proxy deal, and it fell to pieces. And he found himself in a hotel lobby on the Saturday before Mother's Day. And in the Mayflower Hotel lobby, he got thirsty. Could see the bar from where he was standing. Probably could hear the ice clinking in the glasses. And he had a thought, different thought than he had ever had. He said, I've been looking for a lot of drunks to keep them from drinking. I need to find a drunk so I don't drink. And that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. He looked for a drunk not to drink. And through a series of divine coincidences, he got put in touch with a lady who knew a lady who had a husband like us. And he talked to Ann Smith that day before Mother's Day, and her husband was passed out on the floor. And he woke up enough, he called, I understand you got a husband with a drinking problem. Dr. Bob woke up long enough to say, tell dude I'll give him 15 minutes tomorrow. And they traveled that next day. And they met at the gatehouse at the Cyberling Estate. And that 15 minutes turned into about 5.5 hours. And those two gentlemen set about looking for people like me and you. It's a depression. Right time in this country for something like that to take hold. It was a depression. Nobody had no money. A lot of desperate people. And in 2 years' time, those two gentlemen counted noses. And they said, we found about 40 people staying sober between New York, Cleveland, and Akron, Ohio. About 40 people. And I always like to think the New York hustler must have looked at the Akron physician and said, how are we going to let Ralph know when it's his time? They said, we'll put it in a book. Now, that's not exactly why they said it. They said, we'll put it in a book because we're going to open a string of hospitals and we're going to, you know, we're going to step up. But they said, we'll put it in a book. And that was in 1937, and they commenced writing that book in 1938. And that book was published in 1939. I hit this earth sometime later than that. I hit you guys later than that, and it still impresses me that they put me in that book. And it's instructive how that book started. And I think that's what led Bill to pen in the first paragraph of Chapter 7. Practical experience shows that nothing ensures immunity from drinking as much as intensive work with another alcoholic. Practical experience, his own experience. When all else fails, when writing inventory, when talking to spots, when everything else, now all these other methods, they work, but when everything else fails, nothing ensures immunity from drinking like working with another alcoholic. Immunity. When I think about immunity, I think about my immune system. And when I think about my immune system, we have a virus that is 21st century AIDS, you know, immune deficiency system, something that attacks us. And I think if I'm not working with new people, if I'm not working with another alcoholic, I'm probably walking around at risk of spiritual AIDS. That's my immune system. Nothing ensures immunity from drinking. And there are some instructions. We don't get to do the true 12-step call like they used to do the true 12-step call, because most of the time we see people, we very seldom see real wet ones. We get people from treatment these days. We get people from the courts these days. And every now and then, back in the 80s when I first got sober, I still had an opportunity to have a couple. I had one true one that was really through the family. A guy's wife called, talked to her before I even got to know him. That was an amazing experience. It's the, for me, it's the only one that I personally had been on the front line for, where the wife actually called. And I talked to the wife, just like it talks about. And so there are some instructive things in there. Some of it is instructive as the sponsorship. All of it is instructive as to working with new people. And most of it is instructive as to working with an alcoholic. And all of it is instructive as to the proper attitude, you know, to in approaching this deal of ours. You know, when it talks about, and somebody talked to me at the break, one of the breaks, about newly sponsoring. And when it talks about approaching somebody, it talks about, you know, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. When I look at the conditions that are best for approaching a new person, the one that always is the one I have to focus on personally is no lectures to be endured, because I'm a lecturer. I can be a lecturer. Now, there are no things that say, there are some rules, and we don't mean rules, I mean rules in quotes. There are some rules for working with others in 12-step work. For instance, a loose rule is it's hard to 12-step a family member. And it doesn't say that in the book, but one of the reasons for me it's hard is because I can't meet the conditions. When I'm working with family, it's lectures to be endured, it's people to please, I got an axe to grind, you know, and I can say that personally. It's four of us in the program of recovery. I came in 1985. I relapsed and I came back in 1986. When I came back in 1986, my brother Ron was already in treatment. In fact, I came in on what I thought of was a lie, what seemed to be a flimsy read. On October the 11th, on the 10th, I was dodging a guy that I had burned for some money, and then I was dodging this black truck. And I made it back to my house. I was ducking and dodging. And my mom let me in the house on a lie. I said, Mom, if you let me in the house tonight, this morning, Ronnie has already got me a bed in the program he's in. Hadn't talked to Ron. But I called that I called the Harbor Light Center, and they put Ronnie on the phone. I said, Ronnie, tell Mom, tell her you got a bed for me. And you know how when you knew you want your family to, he said, man, I can get a bed. Yeah, they can have a bed for you. That was the flimsy read. I didn't see the hand of God at work then. The miracle was, that was a Saturday. I didn't go out the house that Saturday and Sunday, and I went to the Harbor Light on Monday. That was the miracle. And I went to the Harbor Light on Monday. And me and Ronnie were in the Harbor Light together, and we went home on Thanksgiving of that year, 1986. And my four other brothers were still out there. If Reggie and Rob were here to tell the story, they talked about Ralph and Ronnie showing up like Abby Thatcher showed up at the front door, fresh face and glowing, didn't say a word, deportment shouted, sat at my mother's table, and we were at the table on Thanksgiving, and they were still skinny and sucked up, and me and Ronnie were in there, and when we had a different, there was something different about, conversation was different. Everything was different. That Thanksgiving, I had about 40 days. Ronnie had 4 months. And Reggie came in February of 1987. And that December in 1980, that November in 1987, my brother Rod, the baby brother, is six of us. Me, Ronnie, and Reggie were schoolboys. I'd be student body president, and Ronnie would be student body president, and Reggie would be student body president. We would stair steps, and each one of us, high achievers, go to college. But my baby brother, Rod, dope dealer, did time. He's the only one, did school, all that pretty boy, all, he was different. And when you're working with new people, I'm gonna tell you something, when it's family, it gets different. I don't believe what I know about the program when it's family. When it came to my brother Rod, I thought to myself, some people have voluntarily placed themselves beyond God's reach, and this program can't reach them. And I thought my baby brother was beyond God's reach. I thought he was not going to be one that could get this. And paid him $5. In November in 85, he came to me asking me for some money. And I said, I'll give you some money if you go to this meeting with me. And when we went to the meeting, there was a guy at the meeting that reminded me of my baby brother. He used to deal, and he was slick, and but he was in this thing. And as soon as we got to the meeting, I turned Rod over to Carl P. And they started talking, and Rod got a taste. And he went in the Harbor Light Center, and he left in November, and he called the house. And he asked, can I come home? And me and Ronnie were standing at my mom's house. I said, you can't come here. And he went in the street and stayed in the street for a month. And we don't do the street. We don't do the street. We run to mama's house. Me and my brother, we don't do the street. And on Christmas Day, Christmas Eve of 1987, my brother called. He said, can I come home for Christmas? And I went down on Skid Row to pick him up Christmas morning. Drove around the block a couple of times and I couldn't find him. And I came back the third time and looked like this apparition jumped in front of my car. And he was caked with dirt. And my brother, you know, Leslie, Tamisha, Rod, you know, pretty boy, in the mirror all the time. And I'm like, who is this? And he jumped in my car and I let the window down and rolled home with my head out the window. And we got home to my mom's house for Christmas. And my grandmother was still alive then. And when my mother saw Rod, she buckled. She almost fainted. And she said, don't let my mama see him. And we hustled Rod in the back door and put him in the tub. And when Rod tells the story, he was in the tub, he ran the water three times in and out. And this December, Rod will be 32. The power of attraction. The power of one alcoholic. So I personally am grateful to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful that we have a 12-step. You know, in that case, another guy in my home group did it with my brother. It's four of us. It's four of the white boys that are with you guys. I'm a strong believer in this program and in this fellowship. And my brother Rod doesn't do it like me and Ronnie and Reggie. You know, which is why I guess I'm a little more tolerant of the way people do it. Because he's the one that I'm most impressed with. He was the dope dealer. He was the one when he got sober, he had cats coming at him all the time. Man, why don't you get back into life? Now that you're not doing nothing, why don't you get back as Rod? And he took a minimum wage job working at Walmart. My brother, he's a roller. He's a baller. He don't do that. I saw something changing about him. You know, talk about practice and principles in all our affairs. You know, he's a single dad. He had twin daughters. He don't know where they are. They grown. He's the kind of guy, I send money. He got a little daughter now, man. Oof, I'm amazed. And I'm still, I'm still one, all these many years later, that loves each aspect of our program. I love the fellowship. I fell in love with the fellowship before I did the program. Now, I don't even think about this, but it's the way I live my life. You guys have given me a way of living. And I like to go out and talk about it. And I like to go out and share about it. I like to see the light come on in men and women's eyes. I like to see babies get back with their mamas. I like to see men get back in the house. I like that. You know, I'm that guy. You know, that's why I love this weekend so much with my boy Charlie and the pages. I like to see people walking off the pages. You know what I'm saying? I like to see you walking in your life. Love it when I see men coming in and they vacant. And they got their kids with them, showing up at graduation. You know, and I'm that kind of sponsor. I'm that kind of sponsor. I'm going to be there at your kids. I'm that guy. You know, and, but we ain't got a lot more, Charlie, so I'm going to stop because we need to get all of him we can get. You know.
Thanks,
Rob. Thank you.
Such good stuff. I mean, it's funny. You just can't cover everything when you do one of these things, and especially when I give a 1-hour talk, I rarely regret something I said, but I always regret the stuff I forget to say. You know, I mean, that's really where my regrets come. Is on the way home, you go, oh man, I meant to talk about this or I meant to talk about that, and you know, and you got to trust that God's got something to do with this process, because I really believe the Spirit can speak through a person in a way that different people in the audience can hear different messages, you know, and I think that explains why sometimes you give a talk and somebody will come up to you and go, oh my God, when you said that thing, and I'm like, I've never even heard that before, you know. I mean, I'm going to say it now, but I don't think I said it in that talk. I really think that's just the Spirit speaking to different people and in different languages. And so, 12-step. There's a lot going on in the 12-step. And you know, it's funny. One of the things I talk about, my buddy Chris up in New Jersey, you'll get a link to some of his stuff on this email packet that I send out. But he said something clever one time. He's clever and he's funny and he's super good technically in the book. He said we should put the word actually in front of the steps, you know, where it's like, we actually made amends to those people we had harmed, you know. It's like, really, no kidding. I mean, we didn't just approve of the idea of it, you know. We actually prayed and meditated. We actually, you know, so we actually carried the message to people we had harmed, you know. And it's funny, one of the things that I see, sometimes I see our public relations policy get mixed up with our 12-step philosophy, you know. And I was up in New York one time, and I'm talking to the guys at this conference, and one of the questions I ask, you know, how long have you been sober? And a lot of times I'll say, how many people do you sponsor? And I was talking to this guy, and I go, man, none of you guys seem to be sponsoring anybody. And this guy goes, well, nobody's asked me. And you know, and the idea is, I thought this was a program of attraction rather than promotion. You know, I was like, no, that's our public relations policy. That's not our 12-step policy. And, you know, throughout in the 12-step, it says we go out and find these guys. We go out, we carry the message. We you know, and but it's funny. Ralph was talking about real, you know, actual 12-step calls, and I'm 34 years sober, and I've probably been on less than 10 wet drunk 12-step calls, you know. I mean, then we got interventionists and sober companions and treatment centers and sober living, and you know, and we hand off a lot of that responsibility to people, and those people are doing a lot of work. The first 7 pages of Working with Others, though, do a beautiful job of describing a 12-step call. And I always tell people, if you're going to talk to somebody that's drinking, you know, it's because there was a time when if you had called me and said, my brother's in Austin and he's in trouble, I would have gone and gotten him and taken him to a meeting, you know. And now, that's changed quite a bit. I mean, by the time we go to a meeting, he's going to feel like it's a break, you know, because we're going to go sit down, we're going to talk about what it means to be an alcoholic, and we're going to establish that, and then we're going to talk about what it means, you know, what we offer and what we do, and then we go to the meetings to be around other people. I go to meetings now for 2 reasons. One is fellowship. I love drunks. I love the fellowship and everything, but it's also a great place to find people that don't have any idea what to do, you know. And one of the things I told my boys one day at the table was, I said, if 95% of our meetings are open discussion meetings, there's a 95% chance that a new guy in trouble is going to wind up in a discussion meeting. And if we're all huddled up in our little pockets of enthusiasm over here, we're throwing this guy to the wolves. I can't sit there and talk about the watered-down message that he's getting in the rooms if I'm not in the rooms, you know. But what I go to the rooms now, it's a different purpose. I'm looking for people that, and sometimes when people share, I'm thinking, how would I address that? What's the way that I could be effective in talking about what they're talking about and that sort of thing? But one of my favorite things to do when I'm looking for, if you're looking for people to carry the message, because in the rooms, this is one of my favorite tools. I want to pass this along to you before my little brain forgets it. We have a lot of fun in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a lot of joy in our fellowship, and we say stuff, and people laugh, and we're all laughing. And now, when I hear people laughing, when the room cracks up and laughs, that's when I go to work. because not everybody's laughing. And when I hear everybody laughing, if I'm on my game, I'll look around the room and I go, somebody ain't laughing. You know, there's going to be somebody in here that don't think a damn bit of this is funny. And that's my target, you know, because that's a great chance to, and he might be brand new, he might be 25 years sober. You know, and sometimes you go, you know, that's the guy to go up to and go, how you doing? You ever been here before? I mean, on that attraction rather than promotion thing, one of the most dramatic stories of carrying the message in my experience has been one time I was at just a noon meeting, and there was a guy, I'll never forget, about a 6 foot tall, red haired guy, and he says, I'm at my first meeting. You know, anybody here for their first meeting? He says, yeah. And at the end of the meeting, he stands right there, the double doors that lead out of the room, and he looked like I'm looking at him, and he looked like a boulder in a river, because everybody leaving the room is just going around him like that. And they're all like, keep coming back, welcome home, you know, stuff like that. But he's kind of going, when are we going to talk about how to not drink, so I just walked up to him and I said, so you're brand new, you never been here? And he goes, yeah. And I go, you're going to need a sponsor at some point. I said, that's just somebody that shows you what we do. It doesn't cost a dime. It's part of what we do, because, you know, they don't know that it doesn't cost anything, you know. And I go, it doesn't cost a dime. It's part of what we do to stay sober. And I'd be happy to do it for you. He goes, oh, thanks, I'd really appreciate that. And we go back to my house, and we go through the steps in about 4 days, you know, of going through the steps. And this guy had a bona fide spiritual awakening, and he went off to carry the message. At one point, he's carrying the message into these foreign countries where they don't have anything. I'm trying to keep him going to the meetings. He goes, Charlie, I think I need more God. And he goes off to seminary. And now he's the recovery pastor at this big church in Dallas, a big one. And I watched what happened with the guy, you know, just the ripple effect of walking up and going, you're going to need some help. You know, Mark used to say, giving me this book and expecting me to get it is like giving me the flight manual to an F-16 fighter jet. And then saying, now, once you've read this, we have one out in the parking lot, you know. Try not to hurt yourself or anyone else while you're flying it. You know, it's like, I'm going to need some instruction. I'm going to need some clarity, and that sort of thing. You know, one of the things you hear people saying is like, well, you know, look for. I've had people run up to me and go, we need to hook this guy up with so and so because he's a lawyer. We need to hook him up with a lawyer, and we need to hook this guy's. And I'm like, what is it? I had a guy call me, one of my sponsors called me one day. He'd been at this clubhouse, and they said, he called me, and he goes, you know, they said at the meeting today that you can't sponsor anybody unless you've been sober for a year. And I said, well, let's talk about it. I said, you know, first of all, that's their group conscience, and if that's their group conscience decision, we don't want to. But what does the 12 steps say? It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I say, have you had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? He goes, absolutely. I go, well, let me ask you this. Do you think there's anybody in that room today that had over a year of sobriety that has not had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? And he goes, well, probably. I go, probably about half of them, you know. But in that meeting, we got to follow their group conscience. One of the things I was trained on early on was that if group conscience has a decision, if group conscience has an opinion on something, and I have an opinion on something, my opinion doesn't matter till the next group conscience meeting. You know, I had a guy get up one time at a thing, and he goes, at a big conference, he gets up there, I'd let him go if he didn't have a tie on. I was trained to wear a tie. My first sponsor told me, you know, if you get, now it's different in a workshop, but at a regular, he's like, you wear a coat and tie when you get up behind the podium. And because one time he goes, Charlie, it's okay if you don't want to wear a coat and tie. And I was like, oh, good. And he goes, I mean, you still have to wear one. But but it's okay if you don't want to, you know. And this guy gets up at a conference and he goes, You'll notice I'm not wearing a coat and tie, he goes, because I also go to Al-Anon, and you can't tell me what to do, and my head exploded, you know. And unfortunately, I was coming up after him, and I said, you know, the guy that didn't wear the tie, I said, the way I was raised is if group conscience has an opinion, and I have an opinion, my opinion doesn't matter till the next group conscience meeting. So if group conscience says you wear a coat and tie when you get behind the podium, you either wear a coat and tie or you keep your ass from behind this podium. And he went and talked to Katie after. He was scared of me, but he came up to Katie. He goes, I was the guy that didn't wear a tie. He goes, I'm seeing that differently now, you know. But it's funny because I'm just scatter shoots of shit. But before I forget about it, remember I've been stamping a bunch of people's books with the circle and triangle, and we talk about the three. It represents the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the reasons I like to have in my book and like to have my guys have familiarity with the circle and triangle is one of the sponsorship tools that I use is what we call the circle and triangle exercise. You're familiar with that, aren't you? In the circle and triangle check-in, we call it, unity is the fellowship, service is service work, and recovery is the 12 steps. And if we say, okay, before we start the meeting now, let's do a circle and triangle check-in. And each guy goes around and goes, let's see, unity, fellowship. I went to two meetings this week, and then the thing, you know, and okay, and then I went out to coffee with the guys after the deal, you know, that's what. And then service. And it's funny because I never know whether to put sponsoring guys under service or under the steps. But as far as service, like, well, I got the coffee commitment at this meeting, and I'm the assistant GSR at this meeting, and that sort of thing. And then steps, I did probably 4 evening reviews this week and 6 morning prayer and meditations, you know, I think I did 2 fifth steps this week, you know, one with my sponsor and one with a friend. And you can get, in a really short amount of time, you can draw a pretty good bead on where a guy's at with that little circle and triangle check-in. It's an interesting tool to plug into your life. Because in the sponsor guys, it's amazing how clear things can look when you're hearing it come from the other guy. Now, I can't tell you how many times a guy will call me, and as we're talking, it comes out, he's like, well, I haven't been going to any meetings, you know. When was the last time you wrote? It's been a long time since I wrote inventory, and I'm not doing any evening reviews. I really need to start doing that, you know. But I get out the door and I go to work. I haven't been doing any prayer or meditation, and he's calling me because he's in trouble, and I go, let me see if I got this right. Seems like what you're telling me is you're not doing anything and you don't feel very good. You know, and you're like, let me tell you the story one more time, Spons. You know, I mean, but over and over, that's the way we do. So yeah, I like to talk about that circle and triangle act because Mark used to talk about, I can't live off of food I ate last week and I can't stay sober off of spiritual awakening I had 30 years ago. So it's ongoing work, but another thing he used to say is if you're not happy with the relationship you have with the sponsee, it could be because I haven't clearly defined the terms of the relationship. Sometimes if I don't tell the guy, I'm going to expect you to honor commitments that you make, and because that was a foreign concept to me. You know, when I say I'll be there at 4:00, there was an unspoken, unless something else comes up, you know. And my sponsor was big on doing stuff because you say you're going to do it. And this is going to roll right into another little piece I'm going to have some fun with. One of my buddies, Chris, talks about that most of the problems in AA could be solved by strong sponsorship. It got me thinking one time. So if we're going to solve things, and I could use some help on this, so if you come up with any ideas later, to email them to me, because I'm always adding to this list. But the idea that occurred to me was if lot of the problems in the rooms could be solved by strong sponsorship. What are some of the things that we would tell a sponsee other than how to work the steps, you know, and that what are some of our principles on it? And now, I even thought about putting together a pamphlet, but I'm still working on the name for it. I thought about calling it Stuff My Sponsor Yelled At Me About, or, you know, or something where you could just, when a guy's new, go, here, stick this in your big book and flip through it in meetings, you know, and here's the list I have so far. Lead from the front. This is not living amends. Put AA first. Pray. Make your bed. Don't interrupt people. Fill your hands without being told to. Show up 5 minutes late for the meeting with a Starbucks in your hand. When you chair a meeting, have a topic. Keep it tight. Don't talk too long in meetings that have 40 people in them. Stay on topic. You don't have to chant. Think of other people's perspectives in life. Go to funerals. This is one of the ones that kills me. I had a sponsee go, yeah, my aunt died, but you know, I'm not really into funerals and stuff. And I go, show me the guy that can't wait for his next funeral, you know? And it's like, we go, you know, but boy, if somebody close to you dies and you notice the people that don't come. You know, I don't understand how self-centered that is to go, I'm not really into funerals. I had a guy one time, I was speaking in Oxnard, California, and California has the best receiving lines, you know, because that's another thing on this list is, you know, I was trained, you always have to go thank the speaker. You know, you had to get and go up, even if you just say, thanks for coming, you know, you had to say. And so, and that was something that I'm going to give you a tip to go along with that, though. When you have to go thank the speaker as part of your rules for living, you learn to pray close to the speaker, you know. So when they do the Lord's Prayer, I'm always looking like, as soon as we break, I'm going straight to the speaker. Because, you know, just a 30-second conversation can cost you 40 minutes in that line, you know. So I'm making a beeline as soon as I'll give you that to work with, to go along with that. But I'm speaking out in Oxnard, and I've done the whole 60 to 63. Piece, and at the end of the meeting, there's this line, looked like it went down the hall there, the receiving line, people coming, and I'm talking to everybody, hey, how you doing? They really do good, nice to meet you. And I look over, and this guy is standing around here, and he comes up and goes, hey, man, I just wanted to say thanks. I'm not really into lines, you know, but, and I go, did you hear the piece about 60 to 63, and, you know, the selfish, self-centeredness joke? I go, do you really think these are all people that just really dig standing in line, you know? And he's like, oh. You know, I mean, we learned this. Thank the speaker. Don't like, stay in your seat. That's all about that one at PG. Singleness of purpose. Don't text during the meetings. I don't even like to take notes on my cell phone because if I'm on, and I don't, you can do whatever you want with this one, but if I'm on my phone, the new guy doesn't know whether I'm reading the big book or Facebook. You know, it looks like I'm on my phone. Ask your sponsor before you make a move, right? Every once in a while, it'd be nice if a sponsor would just come in and go, hey, here's what I'm thinking about doing. What do you think? No. You get the cleanup role, you know? where they go, I know I said I wasn't going to go back over there, but I went back over there, you know? And, look for the guy that's not laughing. Build character. Do esteemable acts. Mark used to say most people arrange their behavior to match their values. He said, we lower our standards to match our behavior. Don't steal. Don't story steal. Don't lie. Keep commitments. Here's a good one. Try to date single people. Actually do the steps. Look for the newcomer. Greet him. Get some sleep. Put the baby to bed. Wear a coat and tie when you speak. Don't date for a year. I got some question marks behind that one. Don't put yourself in your first column on the amends or on the amends. Put money in the basket. Don't gossip. We don't shoot our wounded in AA. These are all byproducts of the principles of the, and then I had a couple more on the back here. Have a home group. Go to group conscience. Get a commitment. I've had a lot of fun with those over the time, but I mean, I'll leave it out, yeah, sure. And like I said, if you come up with any good ones, it's fun to add to the list. I'll put it right here. Sponsorship. Now, one of the questions that come up is how many is too many? And when you say how many sponsors is too many, I think we're asking the wrong question. And the question for me is always, can I handle one more? And but then now I'm not a guy that says I always say yes. I probably sponsor 25 or 30 guys right now, and that's just a lot. You know, I got a business, I got hobbies, I got kids, and I got an active AA life. But I won't ever leave anybody hanging. I don't like to leave somebody twisting in the wind. If a guy comes to me, and then when I'm sponsoring guys, I'm training sponsors. I tell these guys, I don't sponsor guys that don't sponsor guys. You know, if you're a taker, we're not going to last that long. You know, I'll get you through the work, but if, you know. But if a guy comes to me and says, hey, man, can you sponsor? There are times where I go, look, I would be lying to you if I told you that I would be available as a sponsor, because you're going to get frustrated. I'm going to be off in Conyers, Georgia when you're in trouble, you know, if you're in it. But I know this guy has gone through the steps because I took him through the steps myself. You know, and you get, and so in that way, you're building this network of guys. And you know, I don't like to just leave them hanging. But. I want to read one last thing, because we talk about that in AA, it's kind of like when you lose pressurization in the cabin of an airplane. You put your own mask on, then you help the people around you. I always say, if you want to see what I really believe, don't listen to what comes out of my mouth. Watch my feet. Follow me around. You'll see what I believe. And here's the thing. It's called the Living Sermon. I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather one would walk with me than merely tell the way. The eye's a better pupil and more willing than the ear. Fine counsel is confusing, but examples are always clear. The best of all the preachers are the men who live their creeds, for to see good put in action is what everybody needs. I soon can learn to do it if you'll let me see it done. I can watch your hands in action, but your tongue too fast may run. The lectures you deliver may be wise and true, but I'd rather get my lessons by observing what you do. I may not understand the high advice you give, but there's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. That's powerful stuff. Our teachers in AA are students, you know, and I don't try to sit up here and act like I'm perfect. I hope not, because I still got a long way to go in this deal. But getting the opportunity to have this experience and to share this experience is the high point of my life. And it's not something that I ever take for granted. It's only been about 18 years ago, one time that the guy that had the 41 years, he called me one day after we'd been doing the work, and he goes, I had two more people ask me to sponsor him today. And I said, really? I said, can I ask you a question? I said, before we started doing this work like we're doing, I said, were you sharing in meetings? And he goes, I shared in every meeting I ever went to. And I said, was anybody coming up to you and asking for your phone number? He goes, oh, no, no. I've been working on, besides that list, I've been working on a test called for untreated alcoholism, and it's going to be kind of like Jeff Foxworthy's You Might Be a Redneck If. I've been working on this thing about you might be an untreated alcoholism. I mean, one of them was going to be, if you share in every meeting you go to and nobody ever asks for your phone number. But, you know, yeah, if you're not sure where your big book is or when the last, you know, yeah, that's, but it's amazing to watch people that are in trouble. And real alcoholics are drawn to real solutions. So once you start having an experience and sharing experience in meetings, people are drawn to it. And next thing you know, you don't have to go out and fight for sponsees. You have people are coming up to you all the time. And it's just one of the gifts of this program. So the last thing I want to say before we do the Ask It Basket. And this, I really do, I hope I'm not giving you guys too much credit, but I really feel like in this environment, we're talking about pocket of enthusiasm. But in a lot of conferences you go to, everybody's seekers, and people are wanting more. People sense that there's more. Marks say, I spell more. And and people think there's, and there is probably more than what I've been experiencing. But the thing that happened, the thing I want to warn against, is in a weekend like this, we get right up next to the solution, and we hear the solution, and we get hope, and we hear people talking about having a different experience, and we hear people talking about how, what happens is, after we break here, everybody's going to get in their cars and they're going to go home. And it's going to be their kids and it's going to be their family and it's going to be their jobs. And what happens is we get right up next to the solution that we can, and then we fall back into our lives. If you've heard stuff this weekend that you feel like you could or should be doing, if this is a program of action, get with somebody and say, I want to go through that deal. I want to write that inventory. I want to talk to you about making that amends. It will change your whole life. And there's no way of guessing the effect it's going to have on your life and the people around you. Thanks for having me.
So we've got about 10 minutes. So if you have a question, go ahead. Ruth and Steve.
Hi, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a great sponsor. I'm going to do what my sponsor did with me when I sponsor. But you mentioned things like checklists and other practical things. Like, are there websites? Are there information other than human parents that are practical? Like practical things?
There are lots of websites, and there's an explosion on social media now. But you have kids? Sponsorship is like parenting. People can say, before you had a baby, you might go on websites and look for all kinds of tips about parenting and the rest of it. And you can listen and you can come to workshops and the rest of it. But you're going to develop it in the sponsorship by sponsoring.
One of the things that do both mics work at the same time?
Yeah. I turned you down a little bit.
One mistake I made is I had a loyal, faithful sponsor who I love with all my heart, and I started getting around some people that were doing things at a different level, and they were saying stuff that he didn't say. And the big mistake I made was it never occurred. He was 5 years sober at the time when he picked me up. It never occurred to me to go back to him and go, hey, Jim, I'm seeing some new stuff. I'm hearing some people talking about stuff. Is this worth looking at? Is this something we should be checking out? I just judged him for not knowing it and went and got me a new superstar sponsor, you know, and never gave any consideration to how that would, you know, he opened his world to me for 5 years. And I dropped it like yesterday's newspaper. It never occurred to me to go to him and say, hey, I'm seeing, you know, if we're going to grow in understanding and effectiveness, to go to him and go, what do you think about this approach to the amends process? What do you think about this way of writing inventory? You know, is this worth considering? And you know, stuff like that. It just occurred to me when you're talking about your sponsor. Anybody other? Yeah.
I have a question. One of you said, know when to get off the gun.
Yeah, Charlie, I said it, even though Charlie knows it too, because he knows my sponsor that's my sponsor. And what that means is, at a certain point, it's time for writing, it's time for talking to sponsor, it's time for, we talked about that when we got to 6 and 7. And at a certain point, it's time to go to where the writing is supposed to take me. I don't write for the sake of writing. I don't write for the sake of becoming great at writing inventory. I don't write for the sake of becoming great at being insightful at sitting with a sponsee and taking them through it. I write for the sake of seeing what I need to take to the power, then take it to the power.
Would you take a picture of that in case anybody wants to?
What? This is more like a curiosity question rather than mechanics.
besides the basic outline for 11th step, like I know everybody's practice looks a little bit different. I was just curious for each of you guys what your practice or routine looks like morning and night.
The question is, what does our 11 step practice look like? I have a little form that I use for evening review, and I don't always use it. Sometimes, total honesty, I bet 90% of my evening reviews are done first thing in the morning. I get up about 5 o'clock in the morning, and by the evening, sometimes I can barely carry on a sentence, you know. And there's a lot of times I just fall out, and I get up, I wake up 5 o'clock in the morning a lot of times, and I go into my little end of the table, and the first thing I do is get out my evening review form, and then I take those considerations into my morning meditation, and I read a couple of books. I read, you're asking me what I do, so I read Jesus Calling. I like that one, and it's funny because even when I was objecting to the whole idea of Jesus, it's written from the perspective of him talking to me, so it's not like he's saying Jesus says. He's saying, you know, come to me, come close to me, so I could. It made it pretty easy to plug in whatever my concept was. I read Around the Year with Emmett Fox. And then I'll usually read something else. Sometimes I'll read the Bible. That's been fairly new for me in the last few years. And then I have a couple of programs. I do silent meditation. I have a timer, this thing called Insight Timer on my phone that I do some timed meditations with. And I do some guided meditations, too. On a guided meditation, I go longer than I do on a silent one. You know, because I can do 12 minutes if somebody's talking to me, but I usually only do 3 to 5 minutes of the quiet meditation. But I have to stop myself from thinking while I'm meditating, you know. And it's amazing. I really am still a big fan of reading pages 86 to 88. When we met Mark, Katie and I went home, and every morning we would pull two little pillows out of the bed and we'd turn to page 86 and I'd follow those clear-cut directions. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. Boom, we consider our plans for the day. Boom, we said, what I got going on today? We may face indecision. My default reaction is not to ask God for intuitive thought or reaction, or to relax and take it easy, you know. So, and it talks about the right answers will come after we've tried to. So it's an amazing. So I do that a lot too. And then, on good days, as I'm going through the day, I actually will pause when agitated or doubtful. I mean, Danny Brown called me one day. He goes, you know, I know when I'm agitated. He said, but I'm rarely doubtful, you know. And so, I always say I'm often wrong, but never in doubt, you know. But yeah, that's kind of what my day is. And I'd love to be half the man Katie is, because her morning disciplines are amazing. But that's what I got on it.
Steve, is he still in here? Steve had a question.
Oh, yeah.
Any other questions?
I want to
hear Ralph answer.
Yeah.
And when I get with somebody, Charlie, Bob, Daryl, some of my friends, you know, my practice is nowhere near as disciplined and nowhere near as consistent, you know. And so, I don't know what that says about me. I know what it says about God, and I know what it says about the program. You know, because it'll feel like you got to really be this. And apparently, you can be somewhat of a guy like me. I don't hit it every morning. You know, I have friends, Charlie gets up at 5, I have friends who get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I hate to share one of these with them, because when that question comes up, they say, I get up at 4 in the morning. My sponsor has 32 readings he does every morning. You know, yes. Now, he's only, of those 32, it's a snippet. My sponsor is also effectively retired. You know, I am I'm an in it guy, you know. So what I do is guided meditations. I very seldom do meditation on my own. my boy right there. Tarek embarrasses me as a sponsor. I'm like, God damn. You know, you know, embarrasses me. But I'm an example. God don't make too hard a turn to those who seek him. You know, I'm not one that is every morning consistently, but I have a practice. Me and my and a circle of my sponsees, not all of them, send nightly review. You know, we have a template for it, and send nightly review around and morning meditation. And so we'll review the morning meditation, send the nightly reviews out. Sometimes I'll miss, and every morning on the way to work, and Leslie gets mad at me too, because we live in different states. We live in different states. So communication for us is really kind of vital, and she's 3 hours ahead of me. But for me, when I'm on the way to work, there's nothing. I got somebody in the CD every morning, you know, and as they're talking to me going to work, you know, I'm getting ready for my day. Sandy's talking to me, Tom's talking to me. I'm a CD guy. I'm a CD guy. Now people will say that's not part of a spiritual practice. It's part of, and so instead of doing the reading every morning I'm doing listening. So my practice is extremely undisciplined relative to some people's. And throughout the day though, it's way more consistent. You know, I'm a pauser and walker. You know, sometimes when they say pause when agitated, especially fellas, this works at work, pause when agitated. When you're at home, not only fellas, ladies, sometimes you gotta pause and walk. Pause and walk, because they might still be talking when you're pausing. You know, pause and walk, you know. You use that one, pause and walk, because sometimes you pause and they still talk and you'll be, okay, I don't, my pause button is off, time for me. So pause and walk, you know.
More questions.
So Charlie, what do you think about?
I know there are some questions out there. Somebody is a little confused or baffled, bewildered about something they heard this weekend. Maybe scared to ask a question. I know we got a lot of active step workers in here.
Well, I have a couple of things on that. One, I do a big book workshop every Sunday that I've been doing for the last 32 years. So part of the practice on that, because I guess you're asking, I think you're asking about sponsees, but I work with about two, so we do that. I've been doing that every Sunday. And I'm more like Charlie with brand new sponsees. With brand new sponsees, I am more apt to put them with sponsees because I'm a guy that is extreme. I sponsor men and women, and I don't know how many people I sponsor. Sometimes they'll say, how many people do you sponsor? And there was an answer that came up that I used some of the, about half of them. About half of them. So they keep me busy. And Clancy had another answer. How many people you sponsor? And he would say, I'm one short. I don't have a timetable and a template. What you got this weekend was two different approaches going the same place. You know, you got two different approaches going the same place, and there are lots of roads to get to the power. And I'm not a mechanic road. Charlie is mechanics, and Charlie's driven mechanics. And Charlie is extremely knowledgeable. And as he was talking, I was like, there's a lot of stuff I'm taking home with me. But the good news and the reason why I like what Terry brought, there are, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a monolithic group. And what I mean by that is, it's not one face to the alcoholic, you know. And we are not a dogmatic society. We are far from a dogmatic society with one voice, one step, one look. That's why I love sitting here this weekend. I'm way less cookie cutter. you know, and I'm way less being able to tell you with certain. And sometimes, to be honest, because of who I am and who I've been at my core, which is chameleon, want to be like any and everybody else, sometimes I'll hear and I'll be like, damn, I want to take somebody through in 4 days. I want to take somebody through in 4 weeks. But you be who you are. You know, a lot of times people say, I'm going to sponsor like my sponsor, you know, and you sponsor inside your personality too, you know. And inside my personality, I'm not, Tara could tell you, you know, I'm not a dictatorial guy. I'm not a hard guy. I'm not a finger in your face guy. If you're a player in the game, I'm going to give you the playbook. If you're not a player in the game, I'm going to try to make the game look so attractive that you're ready to get in the game, and then we'll have the playbook. I believe that the spiritual world and realm is very broad and inclusive, you know. And so that's, so I didn't give you a direct, because I don't have one, except that we've been moving, you know, like I say, that most of the people I sponsor now, I guess probably 80% of my sponsees are over 20 years sober. So I don't know at what rate we all went through all 12, and most of the people I've sponsored have been through all 12 steps.
Okay, any other questions? All right, let's give Ralph and Charlie.